61. That was a little more challenging, that one, I would assume. Okay, so we finished. We're still week four. That's why we got to get hurry up and get going. Okay, so we talked about all the bones of the skull. We did the frontal, parietal, temporal, did the sphenoid. We talked about a bit about the sphenoid. And the occipital. I believe, did we do the occipital?
Very, very briefly.
Yeah. So the thing we have to remember, I think I said it last week when we discussed the frontal bone, and we said the frontal bone goes all the way around and creates the roof of the orbit. The occipital bone is the same. We think of the lambdoid suture back here, this inverted V that represents the suture between the occipital and the two parietal bones. We have to understand that there is some exposed area here, and then you guys have been touching a little bit of suboccipital region, which represents this superior nuchal line that we see here, but that the occipital bone goes all the way to the front of this huge hole called the foramen magnum. So it goes all the way down around, and it includes this foramen magnum, this large hole that we see here at the base of the skull. So it takes up a lot of the base of the skull, especially the posterior base of the skull. So we say it forms the base and posterior aspect of the skull. Inferiorly is a large hole called the foramen magnum, which we find some neural tissue, which is the transition between the brain and the spinal cord, known as the medulla oblongata. And a lot of function kind of happens there in terms of respiratory center, cardiac center, and so forth. And the medulla, as I said, it is exits the cranium and continues to the spinal cord. On either side of the foramen magnum are two condyles, which are for an articulation between C1, the most superior cervical vertebra, and the cranium itself. So it's the articulation between C1, and when we get to C1, we'll come back to this, because we'll be talking about the articular surfaces on the superior aspects of C1 as it relates to these condyles, okay? We see it here, and note how it goes all the way around underneath. You can see the sutures here, all the way here to anterior to the foramen magnum. On the median plane, just superior to the foramen magnum, is a knob-like projection called the external occipital protuberance. So if you think of that center line, if you come up, some of us have a fairly significant one. Some of us may barely have one at all. So it's at that center line on my model that I have here. Excuse me, represents this big, large surface that we see here. And on yours, I don't know what yours look like. Look at all your bones. So sort of, if you remove this white warning label, it's this little kind of bumpy area right here. This is known as the external occipital protuberance. At the point of that protuberance is an area called the inion. So we have the external occipital protuberance, which represents that large mass of bone that we can palpate here. And on the very tip is known as the inion. A very large structure attaches here, known as the nuchal ligament. We will be getting back to that a little bit later, but it is a significant ligament that we see in the neck. From this inion / EOP, we have two lines that extend outwards from that external occipital protuberance. We have the superior nuchal line, and we have the inferior nuchal line. Okay, so the superior nuchal line is the superior limit of the neck. It extends laterally on each side from the protuberance. We do find a significant number of muscles that find attachment here. And inferior to the superior nuchal line, of course, is the inferior nuchal line, which is, again, another area of muscle attachment. We're going to be spending a lot of time in here, because you're going to be spending a lot of time in here with your patients. It's a fairly significant area where I found a lot of work needed to be done for most individuals, especially if they were coming in with neck pain, headaches, those sorts of things. Did a lot of work in here. But we'll be getting back to that when we get to the muscles, especially of the C-spine. But you can see here in the diagram, you know, you've got rectus capitis posterior major, you've got rectus capitis posterior minor, superior oblique, splenius capitis, sternocleidomastoid, occipitals, trapezius, like a lot of muscles attach in this very small area, all up in this in the suboccipital region that we'll be working on. You'll be palpating in, and we'll be talking about. And the purple represents the occipital bone, and we can see the two condyles here again, which would articulate with C1 when we start talking about the spinal column as it travels inferiorly from the cranium. Okay, so that's the big part. Now we have the facial bone. What's interesting is when we look at a newborn infant that we the newborn infant has a relatively small, immature face as compared to the cranium. You'll note that in a newborn, you'll see a relatively large cranium and then a significantly smaller face. So we say that the calvaria of the newborn infant is large compared with the relatively small facial skeleton. It results from the small size of the jaws and the almost complete absence of the maxilla, which is this upper jaw. It still is developing in the newborn. It's not really there much, okay? So it's not quite developed yet. And also, the paranasal sinuses are still having to be created as well. Sinuses form large spaces in the adult facial skeleton, so they have yet to enlarge in the newborn as well. So the growth of the maxilla between the ages of 6 and 12 accounts for the vertical elongation of the child's face. So when we see the child's face grow, it's not so much the cranium is going to grow, of course, but the majority of it is this elongation of the face as these facial bones start to mature and develop, and the newborn infant's face starts to elongate, simply because the bone's developing. So we've got a few here. The first are the two nasal bones. They represent the bridge of the nose. So when you look in your skeletons, of course, the tip of the nose is gone because that was cartilaginous tissue and skin. So, of course, being soft tissue, it's long since decomposed and disappeared. But you can see that there is a bridge of a nose there that represents the cavity where the tip of the nose would be. There's one on either side. There's two of them. They are known as the nasal bone. By the way, what does unpaired mean? Only one. It's either paired or unpaired. It means it's a bone that's not paired. There's only one of them. Okay. So it forms a bridge of the nose. It articulates with the frontal bone superiorly, the maxilla inferiorly, and the ethmoid kind of in behind. So we can see here is the nasal bone in purple. We can see sitting on top of the maxilla. And here in the facial, the full skull, the full skull itself or the cranium, we see the two orange, which represent the two nasal bones. When you break your nose, it's not usually these bones that are broken. It's usually the cartilage at the tip that gets broken. You can fracture these bones, for sure, but the majority of the time, because it's the cartilaginous part of the nose that sticks out, it's the one that's vulnerable to get hit. Anybody here broken their nose? Yeah? Was it sideways? Okay. Mine got crushed from the front. Like when the guy hit me, I could feel his forehead on my cheeks. Yeah? And then I hit the floor, thought, oh my God, what happened? I was playing basketball and I threw a pick and the guy didn't take it. So I stepped out from the pick and he ran right into me and crushed my face. And I'm on all fours and literally it was like someone turned the tap on in the tub. That's how much blood was pouring out of my nose onto the floor. It's like, wow, there's a lot of blood here. Maxilla, there are two. That represents the upper part of the jaw. So, you know, the nasal bones we're talking here. The maxilla represents this upper jaw. There is no mandible on this skeleton at this point. So this part represents the maxilla. Okay, there are two of them. They're united in the median plane at the intermaxillary suture to form the maxillae or the upper jaw. If you take your tongue and run it along the front part of the roof of your mouth, you should feel a line of soft tissue there, yes? That represents the maxillary suture where the two maxilla come together to form the full maxilla. As adults, okay? The suture is also visible on the hard palate where the palatine process of the maxilla unites. We'll talk about that in a minute. Each maxilla consists of a hollow body that contains a large maxillary sinus. Now, you don't see that on your model, but I have a model here where the front of that maxilla has been removed. So we can see here in this model how it's still intact here, right? You can see that's an intact maxilla here, but you can see where the surface has been removed. And the roots of those teeth actually sit up in a sinus. Okay? So there's actually a space back there behind that maxilla that you don't recognize there, but it's quite a large space. And as I said, you can see the roots come right up into that sinus. Remembering that sinuses were created, right, where we had mucous membranes infiltrate and create these hollow spaces within the skull. Ouch. So a hollow body containing a large maxillary sinus, a zygomatic process that articulates with the zygomatic bone. So we talked about the, what? We talked about the zygomatic bone and the temporal bone. Now we have this little bit here where we find articulation. So we say a zygomatic process that articulates with the zygomatic bone, which we can see here. Right, the orange represents our zygomatic bone. Here is our maxilla that we see here. And this is the articulation with the zygomatic bone that we see here between the green and the orange. A frontal process that articulates with the frontal and the nasal bones. So we can see here again, this frontal process is articulating with the nasal bones here and a little bit of the frontal bone on either side of the nasal bones superiorly. A palatine process that articulates with other maxilla to form most of the hard palate. Now, you can see it a bit, but it doesn't work well here. But you have to understand that when we look underneath here, okay, now we have a hard palate and a soft palate. So what, of course, is what you're seeing in your skeleton, again, because it's not soft tissue and bone, you are seeing all of the hard palate. Now, on yours, let's have a look. Yes. If you look in at the hard palate, right, you'll see a flat spot. And if you look anteriorly, just behind the teeth, you'll see there's a line that runs across that divides the front part of the hard palate and the back part of the hard palate. You see that line? Okay, so that line represents anteriorly the maxilla and posteriorly the palatine. And together they form the entire hard palate. So we say, whoops, got the wrong slide. Say a palatine process that articulates with the other maxilla to form most of the hard palate. So they all come together to form that, you know, that's what your tongue is touching when you stick your tongue up on the roof of your mouth, is the whole hard palate. Alveolar processes that form sockets for the maxillary teeth. So again, in my real one, if we remember those alveolar processes, which represents a gomphosis as a joint, right? What these spaces where the roots of the teeth fit in represent those areolar spaces or processes where the teeth roots would fit in. And as we know it, there's one still in this particular model, okay? Approximately 1 centimeter inferior to the infraorbital margin is the infraorbital foramen, which transmits the infraorbital nerve and the vessels. So if you look at this model, okay, this is the orbit. So the infraorbital area would be, of course, the infra part of this orbit. Just below it, right there, is a foramen. Okay, one on each side. Okay, this is known as the infraorbital foramen, and it transmits the nerve and blood vessels. You can palpate this. So if you actually just come down a little bit into this area infraorbitally, you will find, it'll almost feel like a bit of a drum skin where you'll be able to palpate that foramen. Now, some of you have a bit of a minor sinus headache and you push on both of them, you might give yourself a bit of a headache, right? I mean, some of you here may not even have realized it, but when you've had a sinus headache, what do? Right there, right? You're actually pushing on the infraorbital foramen. And you're actually affecting pressure in the orbital, infraorbital, maxillary sinuses if you've got a bit of a head cold. As maxillary teeth are removed, the maxilla becomes smaller, thus marked reduction in the height of the lower face. So I think I asked before, there's no one here from dental, right? There's no DA here or anybody like that. So this is why it's important to maintain your teeth because, again, in the past, As individuals grew older and had tooth extractions done, especially in the upper jaw, the maxilla would actually atrophy and disappear. So their face, remember the old pictures of, you know, in the West, elderly people look like their face all caved in. They have these gums because no teeth and then the maxilla atrophies, then the face kind of collapses in into this last space. So this is why, from a dentistry perspective, they're always trying to get something in there to replace it. Anybody here ever had a crown? How many people have heard a crown? Anybody here ever had your crown fall off and you had to wait a couple of days to have the crown put in? Did it fit? Yeah, my mind fell off too. Okay, so I had one done. It fell out, and I thought, who cares, right? I can't feel anything. You know, it's done a root canal. It doesn't hurt, so I'll just leave it, and I'll go back for my appointment next week and get my crown put on. Guess what? It didn't fit. In 1 week, my teeth had all shifted and narrowed that space where the crown was supposed to go. So that's how quickly your teeth will shift. This is why they want to maintain space, those teeth in there, so that helps maintain the jaw correctly. It also helps maintain and prevents the maxilla and the mandibles, for that matter, from atrophying and getting too small and disappearing. So this is why we have to replace them. So we see here again, it's this green part. There's our two infraorbital foramen there. We've got the maxillary nerve and blood vessels. Sometimes you'll push on there and you'll get a little bit of tingle, which means you're kind of irritating the facial nerve a bit there and you're feeling some numbness. This is when it's removed, sitting by itself. And here again, you can see where the maxilla articulates here with the zygomatic bone. Next is the mandible. This is the lower jaw. It is the largest and strongest facial bone. I have a nice one here somewhere. There it is. This individual was almost exactly the same size as me. It's pretty darn close, eh? So this is the maxilla. It is U-shaped in the superior view. It has a horizontal part and a vertical part. A horizontal and vertical part. The horizontal part is called the body. The two vertical parts are known as a ramus singularly or rami plurally. Okay? So we've got the body and the two rami. Each ramus ascends vertically from the posterior aspect of the body. So if I were to draw a bit of a line right here, this part would be the body, and that back here along this line, this part would be the ramus. So the ramus is vertical and the body is horizontal. The superior part of the ramus has two processes, and you can see them here. There's an anterior one and there's a posterior one. One of them, the posterior one, is an articular process, and the anterior is a surface area for attachment of soft tissues. So we say the posterior is known as the congular process because it makes up the joint with a head and a neck. So you'll see on this view, we have a very wide part here and a very narrow part down here. When we talk about heads and necks, the head is usually quite large and the neck is a narrowing. So we have lots of heads and necks in the body we'll be talking about. So that's kind of the general rule. So you can see this large superior part is the congular head, and the narrow part underneath is known as the neck. All in all, this process is for articulation. Actually, I've got it here. In other words, it fits right in there like that. Okay? So you can see that congular part fits nicely right in there, which allows for opening and closing. So this is known as the congular process, congular meaning articular. The anterior process, the flat piece that we see here, this is known as the coronoid process. So the articular part is the congular process with a head and a neck, and the anterior is known as the condyloid process, which we're going to discover is for attachments of muscles. Any questions? So we can see here, here is our ramus, here is our body in the horizontal plane. We have the coronoid process here anteriorly, and we have the congular process here posteriorly, again with a head and a neck with a narrowing underneath. Okay? Any questions? Sorry?
We can only focus one, right?
Yes. Well, you can. So when I put the bone in and everything's kind of in place, you can see how that coronoid process is underneath the zygomatic bone. Yes, so the zygomatic arch, you can't. But guess what happens when I do this? Does it come out? Is it exposed? Then we can palpate it. So we can't palpate it in the closed position, but we can palpate it in the open position. All you need to do is exactly what you're doing. Find that zygomatic arch right here and find your external auditory meatus. Come just anterior to the meatus, about half an inch. Come just below the zygomatic arch. Open your mouth and close. And you will feel that coronoid process come out and disappear. And come out and disappear. And for some of you, it might be tender. Because some of you may suffer from something called TMJ. Right? And this is why this gets sore. We're going to talk a whole lot about that. So, the congular process is separated from the coronoid process by something called the mandibular notch, which forms the concave superior border of the mandible. So we can see we have the congular process here, the articulating process, the coronoid process here, which is for attachments, but we can see we have a big notch between the two. Right? There's a notch between the two, which is known as the mandibular notch. The rami up and body, horizontal, where they meet is known as the angle of the mandible. And that's easily palpable in all of us, right? We can come along and palpate that angle. This is known as the angle of the mandible. Inferior to the second premolar on each side, so kind of that, not your fang, just behind it, that's known as a premolar, right there on each side is the mental foramen, which transmits the anterior alveolar nerve and vessels. So again, we come out here and down, you have two foramen here. So we had two foramen here, infraorbital foramen, and we have two here called mental foramen. Okay, you got them there? Are they there in the models? Yeah, they're there. And these are palpable too. You can palpate these as well. Two halves of the mandible begin to fuse during the first year and are fused by the end of the second. So again, like the maxilla, two bones that fuse, the mandible is the same. Two sides, right and left, and they fuse on the midline. At the point where the two halves ossify is known as the mental protuberance. You know it as the chin. Okay? So the mental protuberance is where the two pieces fuse together by the second ear. It articulates with the temporal bone where I showed you here on the models to form the temporomandibular joint. So it is the articulation between the temporal bone and the mandible. And we'll be spending a whole lot of time here. So here we go. Head, neck of the congular process. Here is the coronoid process. Here is the notch, mandibular notch. Here is the angle, mandibular angle. This is the ramus. This is the body. And we have the two mental foramen. And then we have the mental protuberance here, which represents the chin. Okay? Zygomatic bone. We've talked about it a wee bit. It's formed by the prominence of the cheeks, the anterolateral rims, and much of the infraorbital margins of the orbits. So we can see it's this anterior part here, kind of that front of the cheek we consider here. We can see how it makes up part of that infraorbital portion of the orbit. Okay. It articulates with the front the frontal bone up here. It articulates with the maxilla below. It articulates with the sphenoid back here, underneath, kind of underneath the arch here, and the temporal bones as well. Note that the temporal process of the zygomatic bone unites with the zygomatic process of the temporal bone to form the zygomatic arch. Should make sense to most of you now. The temporal process of the zygomatic bone articulates with the zygomatic process of the temporal bone to form the zygomatic arch, which we consider to be that whole part. Now, where it's important to have that is when I put the jaw together with the mandible, you can see how the coronoid process fits up behind it and allows the mouth to close appropriately, and that arch that's created allows the mandible to fit appropriately with that coronoid process going up behind the zygomatic arch. So here we've got, here's the zygomatic bone. We can see how it articulates here with the frontal bone. It articulates here with the maxilla. You can see how it makes up the lateral and somewhat part of the posterior orbit here. Here we have the articulation with the temporal bone. So this is the temporal process that is articulating, temporal process of the zygomatic bone that is articulating with the zygomatic process of the temporal bone to form the zygomatic arch. We can see back behind here where it attaches to the sphenoid, kind of coming here, and so forth. So it's that sort of that whole lateral area. The palatine bones form the posterior one-third of the hard palate. I kind of talked about it a bit when we were showing that line in your model on the roof of the mouth. The horizontal plates help separate the nasal cavities. So we can see here is the maxilla, which we've already discussed and talked about. Here is where the two meet along that midline. And then the posterior rest of the hard palate is the palatine bone here that fills in the rest. And again, in your model, you can see that line back here, which separates the anterior maxilla and the posterior palatine. Okay. Lacrimal bone. It forms the medial wall of the orbit. So you think you look inside the orbit, and it forms this medial wall here in the orbit. Okay. It articulates with the frontal bone, the maxilla, and the ethmoid. There should be an E there. I apologize. The lacrimal bones are the smallest in the facial. So we see here, just tucked in behind here in pink as well. You can also see it here in where are we here? Lacrimal. Where are we here? There it is, right here in purple. Okay. The ethmoid is the next one, and it forms the anteromedial floor of the cranium, the roof of the nasal cavity, and part of the nasal septum and medial orbital wall. Okay, so here's your ethmoid here from looking down to the base of the skull, from the top of the skull. It represents this little purple area here, okay? And we can see it. It's set here. If we go back, it said it forms the anteromedial floor of the cranium. Anteromedial floor of the cranium. It forms the roof of the nasal cavity. So here it is, right here, the ethmoid bone, forming the roof of the nasal cavity. And it's also part of the nasal septum and medial orbital wall. So we don't see the septum too well in here, but we can see it, sort of splitting the right and the left nares that we can see here in the nose being separated into the right and left sides, and it forms the upper part because the ethmoid's up in here, and we can look at it forming the superior part of the septum. Can everybody see looking down the ethmoid here looking in front? So there should be a little part here, and you'll note there should be a lot of little tiny holes there, or what looks like they kind of looks like holes. See them right there? Yes. That's good. A good one, actually. Okay. Everybody sees that? Those tiny little holes. That's... Crack it like an egg.
Yeah, I know.
Got it? Okay. So this ethmoid bone is made up of a number of sinuses which contain mucous membranes which flush nasal cavities. But there are three parts to this. There is what is known as the cribriform plate. There are the paired lateral masses and the perpendicular plate. For our purposes, we're interested in the cribriform plate. The reason why is those little holes that you see are the branches, holes for the branches of a cranial nerve called the olfactory nerve. Anybody want to guess what the olfactory nerve is responsible for? Smell. Right. Okay. So the cranial nerve, that nerve comes right out of the brain tissue and has branches that travel through those apertures in this cribriform plate. And then they're exposed to the outside world through a modified sort of mucous membrane that we'll talk about later, where when chemicals pass through, when someone's cooking or fire or whatever, they stimulate, those chemicals stimulate the olfactory nerve. And we, through having been taught, start to understand the different smells, right? Oh, that's garlic. Oh, somebody's having a fire, right? Oh, somebody farted, right? All those sorts of things. We have all these particular odors. Some of them are learned, right? I've smelled particular scents from different cultures. Some are thought to be not too bad a smell, but they're different for us. So we kind of have an interesting feel for it. The other thing that's interesting about the olfactory nerve, because it is so exposed to the outside world, on occasion some individuals put things up their nose that make us feel better. Cocaine. Because you have direct access to brain tissue through the olfactory nerve. So quite literally, when those who do cocaine snort it, it actually gets embedded into that mucosa and has a direct pathway to the brain via the olfactory nerve. So, the last thing we have to talk about here, if you look at your model, you'll see there's a whole bunch of holes in the base. Now, the cranium is a large, hard container, and it contains neural tissue, the brain. But things need to get into the container and leave the container. So, of course, coming in would be blood. Going out would be blood, right? Oxygen's been removed and there's other chemicals in it. We need nerves that have to exit the container to go out and perform all the various things that nerves do. So the brain has apertures. And you're going to have to know all these by next week. I'm kidding. Gets better. Look at that. Now, here's something that's very cool. A neurosurgeon has to know every single one of them and what's going in and out of those apertures from an anatomy point of view for what they do, right? There's a lot in there. These are the ones that we need to know. You do need to know these ones. So we have rotundum, ovale, spinosum, lacerum, jugular, hypoglossal, internal acoustic meatus, foramen magnum, and what passes through them. You, ladies and gentlemen, do need to know those. Okay? Any questions? What's that? Oh, why? You got a copy of it. Landmarks. We have certain landmarks. Now, you guys started palpating the head yet? A little bit, okay. So the landmarks we need to consider for the skull, we've got the forehead, of course, which is the frontal bone. The orbits is where we find the eyeballs. The zygomatic bones represent the cheeks. The nasal apertures represent the nasal cavities. Maxilla bones are the upper jaw teeth. Mandible is the lower jaw teeth. Laterally, we have the temporal bone, which is where we find the external auditory meatus, which is your ear hole that we see through the ear. And the temporal bone we also find, which we've discussed previously, is the mastoid process. You're going to find the mastoid process is a very central starting point for many palpations in the head once you start getting into full palpations. Posteriorly, we have the occipital bone, the superior nuchal line, which you will need to learn. All of these, you also will have to palpate in lab. Okay, these are all palpations in lab as well. Posteriorly, you have the superior nuchal line and the inion, and the external occipital protuberance. Quite often in note-taking, you will see therapists will put EOP to represent that when they're note-taking with a treatment, okay? The superior skull is formed by the frontal bone posteriorly to the occipital bone across the parietal bones. The very upper top of the head is known as the highest point or the vertex. All right. We'll take a break in about 10, okay? Ish, somewhere in there. So today, you're going to get a sense of how things are going to work in this course, right, for the next number of weeks. Because now we're getting into, we've just finished the bones of the skull. And as I've said, we're going to learn the joints. The only joint we've already talked about is sutures, right? But we'll be talking about the temporomandibular joint. And then from there, we'll be moving into all the muscles that we find in the head, right? And then moving on to the spine and so forth, okay? So let's talk about this temporomandibular joint because it is the one and only joint that we find when we're relating the face and the head. We can see it here. It is known as a modified hinge. Now, what kind of movement does the hinge do? Flexion extension, okay? In the jaw, we don't call it flexion and extension. We call it elevation and depression. Elevation will be what movement that you would call? Elevation is closing the mouth, and depression is opening the mouth. So we can talk about how it's a depressor and an elevator in a hinge. So depression is opening the mouth, elevation is closing the mouth. Protrusion, sticking the chin forward, so sliding, so it's like glide. And retrusion, pulling the jaw back. So we open and close, we can push the jaw out, and we can pull the jaw back, okay? Hinging is depression and elevation. Glide is protrusion and retrusion. We can go one step further within glide, and we can go side to side, but it's still gliding, right? It's still gliding. So depression, opening, elevation, closing, protrusion, protraction, retrusion, retraction, both of the chin, and lateral movement side to side. When we look at this joint from articular surfaces, we have the temporal fossa of the mandible, which is concave, and we have the articular tubercle of the temporal bone, which is convex. Seems like a fairly congruent joint, doesn't it? Right? But there's a problem. What I would like you to do is I want you to put your hands kind of just anterior to your external auditory meatus, two fingers. Slowly open your mouth. Don't start yet. Slowly open your mouth. What I want you to, so you shouldn't be pushing hard. Remember, palpation is like soft touch, right? Listening to your fingertips. I want you to slowly open your mouth when I tell you to. I want you to feel a spin. And then as you continue opening your mouth, I want to see if you can feel an anterior glide. Go ahead. Yes? Yeah. So what happens is, when we go back to here, okay, we initially get this, and that can open our mouth about that far. But to really open our mouth, it has to slide forward, which allows that full opening. Okay? So, close it. Nope. Anyway, I got sour gummies. Okay. We have, kind of looks like this. This is part of the temporal bone. Okay. We said the articulation is the temporal fossa. And then we also have the anterior tubercle. and all of these represent the temporal bone, okay? Now, we have the temporal fossa of the mandible and the anterior tubercle of the temporal bone. So when we look at this jaw coming in, we have the congular process here that represents the head as it travels down to become the mandible. On initial opening, this is doing that, right? Which is causing the mandible to drop down or to depress. But if the, and we can see that this is a relatively congruent joint, right? We have a concavity and we have a convexity, correct? But we noted that as we continued opening our mouths, the mandible came anteriorly. It slid this way until eventually it's sitting here in this position, okay? And I'll do it this way just so you can see it. So now we have a convexity sitting on a convexity. What's wrong with that? It's not very strong, right? So what the body has done, it's actually put a meniscus in here. Okay? And the meniscus would need a circular. Looks a little like this. And it fits like so. So there's some congruency here, and as the jaw comes forward, there's a concavity on the anterior part of the disc, and we continue to have congruency. We're going to talk a little more about this, but everybody kind of follow me? So how many people here have clicking when they open and close the jaw? What you are doing is you're either popping onto the disc or you are falling off of the disc. Okay? So for some strange reason, the relationship between the disc and the mandible is off. Something's gone wrong. And we'll talk a bit about that as we work our way through. So we can see it here. The disc is in place in this diagram. To some degree, you can see it in white. But you see how you have this concavity and convexity relationship. So the temporal fossa is bordered by the articular tubercle anteriorly and the post-glenoid process posteriorly. So we said this is the anterior tubercle here. This is the post-glenoid. Okay, now the post-glenoid actually prevents the mandible from going straight back. Okay, so the temporal fossa is bordered by the anterior tubercle anteriorly and the post-glenoid process posteriorly. Posterior to the post-glenoid process is found the internal auditory meatus, which is your inner ear hole. Okay, so the soft tissue is the external, which you can feel in your ear. You continue into the bony part, you're into this internal auditory meatus. But it helps you kind of landmark in where the temporomandibular joint is. Just simply stick your finger in your ear hole and come a little anteriorly, and you're into that post-glenoid area. And again, stick your finger in your ear hole, push anteriorly, open your mouth, and you can feel the mandible moving away from your finger, right? Okay. I am brutal with my clicker, aren't I? Where did I put it this time? Here it is. Fibrous capsule attaches to the margins of the articular area of the temporal bone and around the neck of the mandible. This is a synovial joint. Right? Synovial joint. Which means what? What must it have? For sure. Synovial fluid? What else? Hyaline cartilage? Ligaments, capsule, and a joint space. And then it has a specialty of a meniscus. So it's a normal synovial joint, has all those parts you talk about. Okay, so we say, posterior to the postglenoid, fibrous capsule attaches to the margins of the articular area of the temporal bone and then comes down and wraps around tight into the narrow part here of the neck of the mandible that is below the congular process. Everybody follow me so far? I suspect a lot of people in here are not pre-reading because a lot of you are reacting like you're hearing this for the first time. I warned you guys at the beginning. I teach that you've pre-read and you've seen this before. If you have not seen this before, this is the problem because now you're confused because you haven't seen it before. You must prepare for class because I'm just going to keep moving forward because I have to. We've got to get through this material. This is why it's so important that you're not hearing it for the first time here. The joint capsule, of course, is loose-fitting, which would make sense, right? If this part of this mandible, this conjugal part of the mandible, is going to slide forward and spin, it has to have a joint capsule that's going to be loose that allows that range of motion of that proximal aspect of the mandible at this conjugal process. You've got to have a loose joint capsule, okay? So we can see it here. Here is the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. We can see here is the fossa. This is the post-glenoid tubercle right here that is just anterior to the internal auditory meatus that we see here that represents the ear. And, of course, the conjugal process of the mandible will fit right up in here. And as I said, when we're opening our mouths, we spin here for a bit, and then that conjugal process slides anteriorly to sit on top of the tubercle. You can see there's the capsular ligament there that's got the whole thing surrounded, again, from the temporal bone here all the way down and surrounds the neck that is below the conjugal head that is the articulation that is the temporal mandibular joint. There are two synovial membranes which line the fibrous capsule. So we have one fibrous capsule, okay, and then we have two synovial membranes. The superior synovial membrane lines the fibrous capsule superior to the disc. So you can see, if this is the meniscus, we have wrong color. Where's my black one? I had a black one. There it is. We have one space here. Okay, this is space one. And we have one space here underneath the disc. And this is space two. Okay, so the superior synovial membrane lines the fibrous capsule superior to the disc, and the inferior synovial membrane lines the fibrous capsule inferior to the disc. So we have two separate articular areas within this relationship of the meniscus, also known as the disc. We have a superior joint space and we have an inferior joint space to the disc or the meniscus. And we can see it here in the diagram. Here is the condyle. Here's the disc that we see here in this grayish area. We have one space here, and we have another space here. This little lined area here represents the hyaline cartilage that we would find both on the part of the temporal bone and on the condyle of the mandible that represents the relationship as the temporal mandibular joint. The disc divides the articular cavity into two separate joint spaces, and you guys absolutely need to know this. Protrusion and retrusion, also known as translation, occurs at the superior compartment, and the elevation depression spin occurs in the inferior compartment. Slide and glide is happening here, and spin is happening down there. Why is that important to know? Your patient comes to you today. They have jaw pain right in that TMJ area, and you're going to do assessment with them. Upon opening their mouth initially, they have no pain. As they move into a deeper depression, in other words, opening their mouth very wide, they feel pain. Which compartment is likely the cause of the problem? Initial is spin, and continuing opening is slide glide. So which compartment is causing the pain if they find the pain on really opening the mouth wide? One, right, the superior compartment. That's why you need to know this. It will come back. Trust me. Okay? It's really important to know. Yeah. Yes, you have a fibrous capsule that surrounds the whole thing, and then you have a synovial membrane that surrounds the area between the superior part of the disc and the inferior part of the temporal bone, and then you have another synovial membrane that is between the disc and inferiorly to the condylar process of the mandible. Yeah.
That's right. Protrusion, retrusion.
At the superior, right, and elevation, depression, spin, happens at the inferior, okay? So it gives you a sense of what's going on. Really important to understand. The articular capsule thickens laterally to form the lateral ligament, which is therefore intrinsic. Do you remember what an intrinsic ligament is? You guys will soon learn that this stuff you got to remember. I said that the articular capsule thickens laterally to form the lateral ligament, which is therefore intrinsic.
Like an internally,
yeah, when we say that something is intrinsic, the fibers are shared. So we say that the fibers between the ligament and the fibrous capsule get shared, so it's intrinsic. If the ligament and the capsule were completely separated free from each other, that would be an extrinsic ligament. So because they share, because it's a thickening of the fibrous capsule, it's said to be an intrinsic ligament, which means it's part of the fibrous capsule. Okay? The lateral ligament, along with the post-glenoid tubercle, prevents posterior dislocation. In other words, a good hit to the jaw, it's difficult to get that mandible to travel posteriorly between this ligament and that post-glenoid tubercle. It's very difficult for the jaw to get back. You're more likely going to break the jaw before you actually posteriorly dislocate it. This way is no problem. This way is more difficult. So we can see it here. Here is our upper joint compartment here with its own synovial membrane. Here's the lower joint compartment with its own synovial membrane. Here is the articular disc or meniscus, which it can be either or named. We see lying in between the two. Here is the articular eminence here of the temporal bone. The post-glenoid tubercle is here. And then, of course, we have the mandibular fossa here. Mandibular fossa is the concavity, and the articular eminence is the convexity. So a jaw that's opening starts in a relationship between a convex mandible and a concave temporal bone, and goes into a convex temporal bone and a convex mandible and the disc between, which helps maintain congruency between the two bones in the joint. This, ladies and gentlemen, is how deep we're getting for the next coming weeks. We can see here, when I talked about clicking, we can see that the disc is here in this picture. This is the normal position. The disc is sitting quite nicely here. And then, of course, normally, as the mouth opens and the mandible comes forward, we see how the disc, which fit partially into the concavity and partially in the convexity, has moved anteriorly with the condylar process of the mandible to maintain congruency between the temporal bone and the condylar process. Abnormally, sometimes what happens, the disc gets too far ahead. Please note for further, something to remember for later on, very soon later on, you'll note that this muscle, part of the fibers of that muscle actually attach to the disc. Now, that muscle that you see there is the muscle that's responsible for spinning and pulling the mandible anteriorly. Does everybody understand that? Right? So for the mouth to open, that muscle is pulling the mandible so the mouth opens. Well, because some of the fibers of the muscle attach to the disc, when the muscle is contracting to move the bone to open the mouth, it's also pulling the disc to maintain it in the appropriate position so that the mouth opens properly. But here's the problem. You're a grinder. You're a clencher. You chew gum like crazy all the time. That muscle gets tight and short, and it pulls the disc forward. So now you're starting from an imbalanced relationship when you open your mouth. The disc is already too far ahead, so you're either clicking onto it, or when you're closing your mouth, you're clicking off of it because it's not in the right place. Just remember this. Every time you click, shave of the meniscus. Click, a little more meniscus gone. Click, a little more meniscus gone. why do they click only when they're eating food? It probably has to do because of the muscles that are required for you when you're masticating, rather than just opening. There's not as much contraction, generally speaking. Sorry? No, it's actually lateral pterygoid, which we're going to learn. I used to have, you know, those workout bars, and they were really, really chewy. Way before Clif bars. It was a protein bar. I couldn't eat them because I'd get about halfway through and I'd start to get pain because I used to have TMJ issues, right? And it would just irritate me too much. It was too hard for me to do, so. No, it was even before them. Power bars. Probably no one here probably even knows what a power bar even is, do you? That's right. There are two extrinsic ligaments to this joint. We'll finish this joint, then we'll take a break. And the thing to remember about ligaments, really helpful, they're always named from where they start to where they go to. Always. So this is known as the stylomandibular ligament. It runs from the stylate process to the mandible. Okay? Helps connect the mandible to the cranium. It's not significant to strengthening the joint, just provides a little bit of stability or balance. Then there is the sphenomandibular ligament, okay, from the sphenoid to the mandible. It runs from the spine of the sphenoid to the mandible. It's very important because it provides passive support of the mandible as it's moving. It also works as a swinging hinge. So when this mandible has to slide forward, it needs a hinge to balance it. And that is the sphenomandibular ligament. Here is your stylomandibular here, coming from the styloid process down here near the angle of the mandible. And here's your sphenomandibular ligament. Again, there's the spine of the sphenoid. And you can see that if this is going to move anteriorly, as depression gets larger, you can understand how this is in a perfect spot for the axis of that anterior glide that the mandible swings around. Can you kind of see that? Right? Yes. Yep. This one hasn't got a. I don't know if I've got a good styloid process. I think it might be on the other one. Yeah. So. You can see the styloid process here, right? So it runs from the styloid process down to here. And then the spine of the sphenoid is right here, and it attaches here and lies flat here, about that point there. So that when the jaw opens, I'm trying to keep my arm out of the way, and it swings forward, you can see how it works as a nice swing hinge for the jaw to open properly. It kind of hangs onto it and allows it to come forward with stability and strength. Okay? The articular disc is concavo convex on the superior surface. Concavo convex on the superior surface, and inferior surface is concave to support. That's not very good. Concave. Let's make it a bit more significant. So we have concavo convex superiorly. And we have totally concave, which makes sense, right? The condylar process of the mandible is concave, so therefore it's going to fit nicely right in here, right? But if we think of the sort of this configuration of the two, of the fossa and the anterior tubercle, then it's got to kind of fit in between the two, right? As the mouth opens, the condylar process of the mandible moves anteriorly, placing the convex process of the mandible in contact with the convex articular eminence of the temporal bone. It must be remembered that at no time does the condyle articulate with the temporal bone. It's always the disc under normal circumstances. The disc always moves along to fit. The outer surfaces of the disc are, of course, attached to the capsule, which helps maintain it in the appropriate position. But we do need to think about that lateral pterygoid muscle that does have fibers that attach to the disc that pull it along when it's contracting. So we can see it here quite nicely. Here's your post-glenoid area here. We have the condylar process of the mandible. Here's lateral pterygoid here. You can see attaching a bit to the disc. Here's our convex concave superior and our total concave inferior. And you can see that as this mandible is going to spin and move anteriorly, the disc will fill in the space so we maintain congruency, which we can see here. Here again is the normal. Now, in the other picture, you saw the disc was anterior in the inappropriate place, but the disc can also be displaced posteriorly, which causes problems as well. Again, you can see, you know, we have this severe anterior displacement of the disc, right? And upon opening and closing, it gets all jammed up, and hence we get the clicking and popping as the mandible rolls onto or off of the disc. That'll be for our treatments when you get down that far. Okay, let's take a break. See you guys about 20 after, okay? Okay, let us continue, please. So in light of everything I've said, you know, we've done the bones, we've done the joints, now we start on the muscles, okay? One bone we didn't take yet, we're going to take it later, it's called the hyoid bone. Have you guys palpated the hyoid bone yet? We will be taking it a bit later. So it's a small bone in your neck. It kind of floats. It's not attached to anything other than tendons. So it does float in the neck and to your neck. We will be talking about it. But for our purposes for now, just think of it as this horseshoe-shaped bone that sits in your neck. And you have muscles that attach above it and muscles that attach below it. And they're very involved in mastication, which means to chew. So we have suprahyoids, of course, which refers to those muscles we find above the hyoid bone. And then, of course, we have infrahyoids, which would represent those muscles that sit below the hyoid bone. And as I said, we will be discussing the hyoid a little bit later. Why is that not working? Hello. Oh, that's because I haven't done this yet, I believe. No, it's working. What's going on here? Try this again. There we go. Okay, so we've got a number of muscles to consider. Now, the temporal fossa is the area in the head, and it is related to the temporomandibular joint. Now, we have to remember that the TMJ, in so much of what we've talked about, and of course, because it's responsible for going up and down, backwards and forwards, and side to side, it is what we use when we put food materials in our mouth and we chew away to break them down to smaller pieces before we swallow them. Chewing is known as mastication. So we say when discussing the muscles related to the TMJ, we have to review the temporal fossa. Now the temporal fossa is represented within this square where we have a number of bones here. We have the temporal bone, the sphenoid, the parietal bones, and so forth, and they're all involved in where we find muscle attachments or things that are related to movements of the TMJ. So its boundaries are posteriorly and superiorly by the temporal lines. Remember, there's a superior and inferior temporal line. You guys remember that? And I did sort of discuss about temporalis, right? Finds attachment. Anteriorly by the frontal and zygomatic bones. Laterally is the zygomatic arch. Remember, you know, the makeup of between the temporal bone and the zygomatic bone. Inferiorly by the infratemporal crest, just inferomedially to the zygomatic arch. Now think about that. Just inferomedially to the zygomatic arch. So in there, right? Behind in here. Where are we here? Behind in here, right? This area here. So you can't palpate that because it's behind your zygomatic arch. It is a regularly shaped space deep and inferior to the zygomatic arch, deep to the ramus of the mandible and posterior to the maxilla. So this sort of this lower fossa, irregular shaped space, sorry, the infratemporal fossa. So this was the temporal fossa, the superior part. Now we also have an infratemporal fossa that lies deeper. It is an irregular shaped space, deep and inferior to the zygomatic arch. So deep and inferior to the zygomatic arch. Deep to the ramus of the mandible. Now I haven't got the mandible on here, but think of where the ramus of the mandible is. And posterior to the maxilla. So we have an upper one, and we have a lower one. Okay, a lower fossa. Laterally is the ramus of the mandible. So think of where that is. Look at your skull, look at your ramus of your mandible. Where's laterally to the mandible? Okay. Medially is the lateral pterygoid plate. Now the lateral pterygoid plate is this thing right here. It's that little thin piece right there. Yes. Okay. This piece right here. Yep. Okay. All right. Anteriorly is the posterior aspect of the maxilla. Posterior is the mastoid and styloid processes of the temporal bone. Think of your area there. Superiorly is the inferior surface of the greater wing of the sphenoid. Inferiorly is where the medial pterygoid attaches to the mandible near its angle. So we're looking here. So there is the temporal fossa up here, side of the head. And here is the infratemporal fossa here. Do you have a question? Or? No, okay. So, let's start talking muscles. We think, you know, those are just sort of our areas where all these muscles are going to originate from. Our first muscle is known as temporalis. It has two attachments, of course. Its proximal attachment is the floor of the temporal fossa and the deep surface of the temporal fascia. Distally, it attaches to the tip and the medial surface of the coronoid process and the anterior border of the ramus of the mandible. Here and here. Again, floor of the temporal fossa and deep surface of the temporal fascia, which we see here. Like, the fascia you don't see here because they remove it all to show the muscle, but think of a big shiny fascia kind of surrounding the whole head. So we see it covering in this area. And we said here, tip and medial surface of the coronoid process, right? And the anterior border of the ramus. Okay? Everybody's like, yeah, okay. Its innervation is the deep temporal branches of the mandibular nerve. Now, here's something you have to think about. You have learned no neuroanatomy, right? And you're not going to get any neuroanatomy from me generally. This is just memory work. You do have a neuroanatomy course in semester 3 where some of this will come to fruition to some degree. I introduce you a bit to levels and you'll get a better understanding as we move through. But ultimately, when you're learning your muscles, it's memory work. Where do they attach? What nerve innervates it? And what's its action? In this case, temporalis is a mandible elevator. So when the whole muscle is working, because you saw in the picture, right? It covers the whole side of the head. When that whole muscle is working as one, it elevates the mandible. The posterior fibers retrude the protruded mandible. So if my jaw is in front and I want to pull it back, it's the posterior fibers that pull my jaw back. So the whole mandible lifts my jaw and the posterior fibers pull back the retruded jaw from here to here. Back is the posterior fibers. The one thing you have to remember about muscles, because remember we said that a motor neuron innervates every single fiber in the muscle, right? so that it makes the muscle contract. Well, it can further refine movements and say whether the nervous system can, whether I want the whole muscle to contract, close the mouth, or whether I want just the posterior fibers to contract to pull back the retruded jaw. Okay? And this is the stuff that you've got to remember to this level. That's temporalis. To palpate it, of course, quite simply, it's the whole side of your head. You touch the side of your head, have your patient clench their teeth, and temporalis will go nice and firm underneath your hand. Okay? The next muscle is called masseter. Masseter attaches from the inferior border and medial surface of the zygomatic arch. I'm going to go a bit slow because what you really need to do here is either A, look at your skull when I say what I'm talking about, or B, within your mind's eye, find that zygomatic arch and think of where I'm taking your mind to. The inferior border and medial surface of the zygomatic arch. So right here. And it goes to the lateral surface of the ramus of the mandible and its coronoid process. So all the way down in a rectangle shape like that. So it's the one, again, clench your teeth with your hand here. Masseter gets really hard, right? Okay? So because it's running from the zygomatic arch to the bottom part of the mandible, what is this muscle likely responsible for? No, movement. Yes, it is for chewing, but what's its movement? You have to start thinking in this relationship, when a muscle contracts, one attachment site is getting closer to the other. Now, because in this case, masseter is attached here at a fixed bone that can't move, right? Zygomatic can't move. The only thing that can move in this relationship is the mandible. And yes, someone said it, it's an elevator. It closes the mouth. We'll get there. Okay, its innervation is the mandibular nerve, cranial nerve 3, via the masseteric nerve, which enters its deep surface. For our purposes today, all I'm after is just the mandibular nerve, cranial nerve 3. Okay, its actions, it elevates, as we said, it protrudes the mandible. Now think of where this is. How does that protrude the mandible? Can you see it? Or does it seem kind of weird to you that this muscle could do this? Here's what's important. The action runs like this, right? Where are some of those fibers in relationship, the superior fibers in relationship to my hand? So my hand is here. What's the relationship of the anterior fibers? They're in forward to the belly of the muscle, aren't they? They're anterior to the belly of the muscle. Therefore, if this anterior part here contracts, it will pull the mandible in that direction because it's slightly anterior to the to the axis of movement. Does everybody see that? Right? Where are we here? Oops, sorry, went the wrong way. The deep fibers retrude. Oh, my God, you're kidding me. No, I'm not. The deeper fibers of this muscle actually retrude. Okay? Pull it back. So those are the two externals. So easily palpable. Temporalis and the temporal fossa, masseter on the outside part of the face. Now we need to get deep. The first of the deep is a muscle called the lateral pterygoid. It has two heads. It has a superior head and an inferior head. The superior head starts at the inferotemporal surface and infratemporal crest of the greater wing of the sphenoid. And the inferior head is the lateral surface of the lateral pterygoid plate. Okay, so here we've got lateral pterygoid, here, two heads. We said the superior is the infratemporal surface and infratemporal crest of the greater wing of the sphenoid here, okay? And the inferior head is the lateral surface of the lateral pterygoid plate, which is right here. Distally, it attaches to the neck of the mandible. This is the muscle that attaches partly to the articular disc, which we just discussed, and the capsule of the temporal mandibular joint, which we see here. See the fibers, some of the fibers here to the disc, and of course the capsule has been somewhat removed, but we see the attachment there. Again, neck of the mandible, articular disc, and capsule of the TMJ joint. Therefore, if this muscle comes from here, and we say it attaches to the disc, and it attaches to the neck, and it attaches to the capsule, when it contracts, what does the mouth do? If it's going to pull the condyle this way, what's its first action? Correct. It's an opener, right? So here we go. Here we see the lateral pterygoid here to the neck of the condyle, the disc, and the capsule, right? It bilaterally, because remember, we have to remember there's two of them, right? There's two of them, one on each side, threading the mandible. When they work together bilaterally, they protrude the mandible and depress the chin. So they can do this, or they can do this, when they're working together, both right and left. When they work unilaterally, they have you go, well, here's the question. When I move this way, which one's working? So if my jaw is going to the left, is it the left pterygoid that's working or the right pterygoid? It's the right, correct? Right, because it's going to pull the mandible anteriorly, remember the two attachments, so therefore the jaw is going to go to the left, right? So it'll have it go contralaterally. The right one contracts, the side to side, the jaw will go to the left side. If the left one contracts, the jaw will go to the right side. Bilaterally, protrusion, depression. They are innervated by the mandibular nerve, cranial nerve 5, via the lateral pterygoid nerve. So that's the lateral pterygoid. Now we have a medial pterygoid. So obviously that's getting... Yes, go ahead.
When you said the master had like out of iteration 3, you're talking like cerebral spine?
No, it's cranial nerve. Whenever you see CN, yeah. So it means it's coming out of a nerve that somehow exited the face or the head. It hasn't gone out of the spine at all. That's five. Oh, did I make a mistake? The three popped in there is cranial nerve 5. My apologies. Yeah, I know. I apologize. So it's 5. The thing to remember, and I don't think they teach us anymore in school, cranial nerves are represented by their Roman numeral number, not a number. It's the only part of the body. So when we're talking about cranial nerves, it's always in Roman numerals. Does everybody know the Roman numerals? I don't know if you even teach them anymore. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. What's 8? Yeah. 8. What's 9? 9 and 10. 12. So then it would be 11 and 12. Yeah, I don't think they teach it in school anymore. Yeah. Because I remember the last couple of years, I'm like, don't you guys know this? And they're like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, what? Sorry about that. That's a typo on my part. So medial pterygoid, we talked about lateral. Medial has two heads as well. It has a deep head and a superficial head. The deep head is the medial surface of the lateral pterygoid plate and the palatine bone. Now just think of where we saw the palatine bone. Where was that? Yeah, roof of the mouth. Okay? So this is again deep. The superficial head is the tuberosity of the maxilla. Distally, it's on the medial surface of the ramus of the mandible. So here is we're looking on the inside of the face. So out there is the lateral pterygoid that we just talked about with the two heads, so the disc and the joint capsule. On the inside of the mandible, here we see the medial pterygoid, right? And here is we've cut away part of the mandible so we can see in. Again, lateral pterygoid is above, medial pterygoid is behind. Again, medial surface of lateral pterygoid plate and palatine bone is the deep head. Superficial head is the tuberosity of the maxilla, and they both come together to attach to the medial surface of the ramus of the mandible, down here, on the inside of the mandible. In here. Okay? Innervation is the mandibular nerve via the medial pterygoid nerve. Its actions, when working together, both right and left, they help elevate the jaw and they help protrude the mandible, pushing it forward. Unilaterally, they protrude the side of the jaw, and acting alternately, they produce a grinding motion. So if you're a tooth grinder, you're overworking this muscle terribly at night. They say the studies show that people who wore braces usually tend to have TMJ problems. I wore braces for 9 years. Yeah, back I'm old. So in my day, they just little adjustments. So I wore braces, I think, from when I was 6 or 7 till I was like 14. And then I wore a retainer until I was 19. And I had railroad tracks. No headgear, though. Didn't have headgear in those days. Yeah, I was great. I wore glasses, I had carrot red hair, and I wore head braces. I got lots of dates. Okay, this is what you need to remember, folks. Here's your movements. So you can take this, right, and then you can start to figure out the movements. Now, we haven't got to the supra and infrahyoids yet, but we will be. How are we doing? I got some great questions in my head for next week's quiz. So, I have a couple of announcements. Firstly, it's getting to be timely in regards to the quizzes. So, I have decided that quizzes from now on will be remotely online. Right? You won't have to do them in class. So we can discuss when we want to have those every week. I usually give a 48-hour window. So I'm thinking Monday mornings at 9 till Wednesday morning at 9. Does that work for you guys?
Yeah.
Okay. So, but tests will still be in class. Secondly, the week of the 17th of October, I will not be here. I will be out of the province. And you will be given screencast lectures for both this and A&P. I don't know if you guys done screencast. Have you got anybody? I think Jen's doing a bit. Yeah. So I'll have screencast that week, and of course your quiz will be online. Okay. That's not next week, but the week after. Thanksgiving. I probably have to do a screencast for Thanksgiving too, because I just don't think we have the ability to just forget a week and continue moving forward. Yeah, because this weekend's coming up Thanksgiving, right? Yeah, yeah, so that's correct. Yes. Yes. Yes, it will be. I know. No, midterm for this, yeah. So there seems to be a bit of a flaw in the syllabus. I think I made a mistake, because usually for this class, your midterm's in week 8. Yeah, usually you go for reading week, gives you a chance to study.
No, week 8.
Week 8? Does it say week 8? Okay, great. Okay. Yeah, the midterm's after reading week. So you got a week to study.
Have a
So remember this. It's called Reading Week, not vacation. For a reason. Yeah. No, there won't be a mistake there. No, I believe so. I'll double check. We'll talk on Wednesday. We mix them up a little bit. Part of the reason for the midterm being the week after in this class is because of all this anatomy material we need to get through for the lab. A lot do it. Yeah, you'll find quite a few of them here. Will be before. Okay, more muscles. Let's just get a couple done. So, all these faces we can make are all from muscles. Now, what's quite interesting is all the muscles that make those don't attach to bone. They don't attach to bone. I literally could make an incision along your hairline and pull your face down to your skull, and all the musculature would stay within the fascia of the face. Yeah. So sometimes people have orbital surgeries, like they've had a terrible fracture of the face, like a hockey player or something. They literally will make an incision, drop the whole face down, and do all the fixations, the pins and plates and everything behind the skin, and then put the face back up again. No, a facelift is they kind of make two incisions here, pull the skin back, cut the excess off, and stitch it. So muscles of facial expression lie in the subcutaneous tissue and are attached to the skin of the face, not bone. This allows us to change the expression, and evolutionary, some anthropologists and sociologists say that these facial expressions are ways of us expressing fear, love, interest, all those things without speaking. And we've kind of embedded them into our normal reaction to each other. Yes. Under the skin. Cutane is the skin, so under the skin. They produce effects by affecting the skin, not the facial skeleton. So that's the key thing. They don't attach to the bone of the face. All facial muscles receive their innervation from cranial nerve 7, facial nerve. All of them. All the muscles in this slide set all have the same innervation. They surround the orifices and act as sphincters and dilators. Around your eye is a sphincter. Your mouth is a sphincter. Okay? Because the face has no distinct deep fascia and the superficial fascia is between the cutaneous attachments of the facial muscles and that it's loose, anytime you get your face cut, the wound gapes a lot. It gapes because there's nothing really holding it together. That's why they look so nasty when really they aren't. So I'm a UFC freak. And so, you know, you see some of the facial wounds from mixed martial arts and it looks brutal. They're bleeding all over the place. But when you actually look at it, it's not super large at all. Yeah. Yeah. So here we can see this is the facial nerve. Now, I think this is a fantastic picture. Because you can see the skin has been peeled away here, right? This is a cadaver, folks. This is a cadaver, okay? It's a cadaver, real cadaver. A cadaver is a dead person that's been chemicaled to last a long time with preservatives. What I like about this is you see the extent of the facial nerve in the face. You know, this is where if they have to do any surgeries in the face or any damage to the face, significant problems can arise. Droop lip, eyelids don't function properly, right? A lot of things can happen. So when they're doing facial surgeries, they're very aware of trying to avoid this facial nerve as much as possible. I mean, look at all the branches here. This is all facial nerve. And it's a cranial nerve, which means it's arising from deep in the brain. Here you can see that a lot of the skin has been removed in this particular dissection, and you can see the muscle attachments here. So the yellow kind of represents fatty tissue, and the kind of the purpley gray, the skin's been left on the nose here, and the skin on the lips has remained. But we see all the skin has been removed here, and we can see all the various muscles and their attachments underneath the skin. How's your hamburger now? Not in Canada, would never allow it. Not here, no. Yeah, the money it would cost to create an anatomy lab would be astronomical. In fact, it's very difficult to do dissections now because they can't get specimens anymore. People are not giving themselves to science anymore. So I know. Let's just finish this. Just do one, just because you get an idea of it. So the first one is a muscle called occipitofrontalis. Again, the name kind of gives you a clue. Occiput, frontal. Sounds like a couple of cranial bones, right? It lies over the occipital and frontal bones. They are connected in the middle by a sheet of connective tissue called the epicranial aponeurosis. So we can see here is frontalis, here is occipitalis, and we have this epicranial aponeurosa fascia that lies between the two. We're looking at frontalis here, and of course occipitalis would be in the posterior aspect. It has an anterior belly frontalis and a posterior belly occipitalis. The posterior attachment is attached to bone, whereas the anterior attachment is the soft tissue, because occipitalis is not face. It's back here somewhere. But the frontal part, because it's part of the face, is buried within the subcutaneous fascia. Therefore, the muscle moves from the anterior attachment to the posterior attachment. Right? So those eyebrows up. Occipitalis, lateral two-thirds of the highest nuchal line of the occipital bone and the mastoid area of the temporal bone. Remember the superior nuchal line, right? And the mastoid area of the temporal bone, two, of course, is epicranial aponeurosis. That would be the posterior part. The anterior part, the frontalis, rises. So posterior went from the nuchal line to the epicranial fascia. The front part goes from the epicranial fascia to the muscle. So from the epicranial aponeurosis to the fascia and skin overlying the frontal bone, which of course is the forehead. It draws the scalp posteriorly, such as when we raise our eyebrows, right? And also draws the scalp anteriorly. Its innervation, of course, is cranial nerve, facial nerve 7. So here we go. We can see these wrinkles that we get here are all occipital frontalis. See you guys next week. No, you won't. Oh, no, almost done. Sorry, this is your first trigger point. Okay, so this muscle is a very, it could be a lot of trigger points in the head because of headaches and so forth. Obviously, a chronic overuse causes trigger points. A trigger point in the occipital belly produces headache pain in the back of the head, and the patient will say, behind my eye. Okay? Back of the head, behind my eye. They may feel discomfort when pressing at the back of the head, like a pillow or the back of a chair. The frontalis belly, so if there's a trigger point in frontalis, it produces headaches in the forehead and possible tingling and prickling pain. Here's your challenge. Brian might ask a question. Your patient comes in the clinic today with a chief complaint of pain behind the eye and the back of the head. Which of the following muscles could be the cause of that trigger point? As compared to, the patient comes in today with a chief complaint of headaches in the forehead and some prickling feeling pain in the forehead as well, and that would tell you which trigger point it is. This is your other next study thing you must do. Not only origin, insertion, or attachments, innervations, actions, and trigger point patterns, if I give them to you. All of this is free for me to examine. Okay? See you next week. Yes.